You're back with Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. Among the pioneers of mountain biking is Mike Rust, who rode around Crested Butte and Salida in the 1980s with his friends and his five brothers. Then, in 2009, Rust disappeared.
As long as we don't have answers, I feel that somebody needs to keep pushing and looking.
I don't think we're going to find Mike. I hope we find Mike. I just don't know what to say about that.
A new film looks into Rust's disappearance, but also celebrates his contributions to mountain biking. Nathan Ward directed The Rider and the Wolf, which premieres this weekend at Telluride Mountain Film. And Nathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ryan. It's great to be here.
And why don't we start with the joyful part of this story, and that is the early days of mountain biking in Crested Butte and what Mike Rust's contribution to it was.
I think it was a heady time for mountain towns. You know, they hadn't really been discovered yet, and they were sort of wild and free. The streets were dirt in Crested Butte. I grew up every summer in a cabin in Taylor Park, which is nearby. So we'd go there, and there wasn't a lot of entertainment either, I think. So I think it was a bunch of miners and loggers and other just free spirits looking for some fun, something to do. And I think that's kind of how mountain bike evolved here in Colorado.
And Mike Rust really is an embodiment of that. Even like the early bikes that he and his cohort would throw together, you know, it's not like you could go to the store and buy a mountain bike at this point.
Mike Rust discovered Crested Butte when he was on a bike tour across Colorado, and he came in and sort of discovered the mountain bike scene, which had already started at the time. This would have been in the mid to late 70s, and there weren't any mountain bikes back then at all, so there were just a lot of old sort of paperboy bikes. The old Swins that people used to deliver papers on around town. But they had fat tires, and so you could actually ride them on trails.
And in this motley crew in Crested Butte is Gary Fisher as well, who's considered really an inventor of modern mountain bikes. And in your film, Fisher calls Rust an inspiration.
That's right. Gary Fisher was actually from California, and so he wasn't really part of the Colorado crew, but they'd come out, a group of them, every year, and they'd meet up with the Crested Butte crew. And they would do the Pearl Pass ride, which is a ride from Crested Butte over to Aspen. And I think how it started was a bunch of mountain bikers were sitting in a bar and they were listening to motorcyclists bragging about how they had ridden over. And one of them piped up and they said, "That's nothing, we'll pedal over there tomorrow." So people that came to really be known as the founders of the mountain bike movement out in California would come out every year and ride with the Colorado guys.
And at this point, not only are there not mass-manufactured mountain bikes, there really isn't a lot of single track either, which we kind of take for granted today.
But there still were trails. There were deer trails and elk trails, and then there were the old mining roads. And so those came to be some of the early mountain bike tracks, and a lot of them still exist today.
Then there's this whole question of the mountain biking ethic, an off-road ethic, and these are the guys who are really helping develop that. I say guys, was it also women?
It was. It was a mix of men and women for sure. I think it was predominantly men, but I think they were always trying to talk more women into riding with them. And these people came from a very diverse background, but a lot of them had worked in the land in different ways. And I think they definitely had an environmental ethic that they were trying to form, you know, and they probably borrowed a lot of that from the early hiking movement as well, since they were all sharing the same terrain.
Yeah, one of the secrets, and maybe this is still true for mountain bikers blazing new trails, literally there, is that you would cover up your tracks for the first 30 feet so that no one caught on to the route you found.
It used to be called the Salida Rules, at least when I grew up here, and Mike Rust and another fellow named Don McClung developed these trails. They would develop them only by riding on them. And at the time, there weren't any other mountain bikes around Salida. So I think the effort then was to try to keep the motorcycles off the trails. So they'd pick up their bikes and hike in the first 30 or 50 feet so that other people couldn't actually find where the trail started. And it actually was really hard to find them even if you were another mountain biker. So things have changed quite a bit these days.
You mentioned Salida because Rust eventually moves from Crested Butte, which he thinks is becoming crowded and a bit touristy, to Salida. But I want to talk a little bit about Mike Rust's family, which is as colorful as he is. He has five brothers, and together they call themselves the Rolling Rust Brothers. And in addition to road bikes made into mountain bikes, as you've described, they made and rode ordinaries, which are also called penny farthings, you know, with that giant wheel in front. It looks like it's 5 or 6 feet tall, and then one tiny wheel in the back. You have some great archival footage of the Rolling Rust Brothers riding around.
Mike Rust would tell anyone who would listen, "Ordinaries are the most graceful, most casual, most regal bicycles ever made."
I saw that high wheel bike for the first time, and I says, "Wow, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen." And Mike looked at me and just said, "No, ride the thing." He gives me the bike, I look to him, and I'm thinking that he's gonna go ahead and give me a lesson on it. And there's no lesson.
He really liked to get people up on an ordinary without telling them how to get off.
What drew the Rust Brothers to these bikes?
Well, the Rolling Rust Brothers, they're definitely a talented and unique family. Their father was in the military, so they ended up in Colorado Springs, and that's kind of how they came to Colorado. I know they had seen a bike, I think it was out in front of a bike shop in Colorado Springs, and it was being used as a sign. No one was riding this penny farthing, and I think they managed to talk the owner into selling it to them, and they fixed it up, and they rode it, and they all loved it. So I think overnight they ordered a bunch, and they didn't like the quality of these bikes because they were falling apart on their first rides. And so being the group of brother machinists, most of them are machinists in some way, they said, "Well, we can do better than this. Let's just make our own." And then even today, Mike's brother Paul Rust owns Rocky Mountain High Wheels in Colorado Springs, and they probably make the most advanced high-wheel bikes that have ever been made in history.
Have you ever tried to get up on one?
Yes, I've definitely ridden a high-wheeler. I wouldn't say I've taken to it like a duck to water. You know, you're certainly 5 or 6 feet above the ground. You know, after they built these high-wheelers, they decided they were going to all do Ride the Rockies, which is the, you know, the big tour across the state, and they would ride these things the full 500 or 600 miles over the mountain passes. And they have fixed gears, so, I mean, there's no way to slow down on the downhill, so they just kick their feet up over the handlebars and be going down the pass at 50 miles an hour on a high-wheeler.
Oh, that sounds just dizzying. I guess at one point they were even sponsored, I think Mike was, by Coors Light.
That's right, and he even had a high-wheel bike, which he called the Silver Bullet.
As we said, he moved to Salida, and Mike Rust started a new bike shop. You've said that you grew up in Salida. Were these guys legends in your childhood?
Well, when Mike Rust and Don McClung, I know they'd been looking around Colorado for a place to start a bike shop, and they were doing it on a budget, so they were kind of looking for the cheapest towns possible. And back then, Salida, you know, you could buy a downtown building for around $10,000, so they ended up setting up shop about 4 blocks from my house. Back then, you know, Salida wasn't a mountain biking town at all. There was pretty much no one riding bikes, you know, except if you had a DUI. I think you rode back and forth to work.
I see.
So these guys came in, and I think in the beginning, they were looked at as a real oddity, you know. They were living in this shop and making bikes, and I think they really inspired a whole generation of people, at least in central Colorado, you know, and they definitely changed this town for the better. I mean, Salida is a mountain biking mecca of sorts now. We have thousands of bikers that come through every summer, hundreds of miles of trails, and, you know, that all really started with these two guys just coming in and leading by example.
You're listening to Colorado Matters. I'm Ryan Warner, and we're speaking with the director of the new film, The Rider and the Wolf. It's a documentary about Mike Rust, who you could call one of the pioneers of mountain biking in Colorado. It is also about Rust's disappearance in 2009, and let's talk a bit about that. So he finds that Salida as well is getting too crowded, and he moves to an even more remote spot in Sawatch County. Describe the house he built for himself out there. The images of it in the film are really striking.
Mike moved out to Sawatch County, which is unique in Colorado. It's in a beautiful mountain area. It's stunning. It's right. It has a view of the Sangre de Cristo peaks. And it's also a place where land was really cheap. So when he sold his bike business, he was able to take that money and he bought 80 acres. And being the frugal sort that he is and innovative, he started collecting, you know, what people would think of as junk, you know, old windows and boards, and started tacking together this house out there. And at the time, there were no building codes out in Sawatch. So you could build pretty much anything you wanted, you know, as wild as your imagination could be. So he started recycling materials and just, you know, tacking little pieces together, and he ended up with this glass castle that stretched across the base of a hillside, perfectly situated for the sun. He actually lived through a San Luis Valley winter in a little plastic tent so he could measure the angle of the sun and places his building in the most optimal position.
There's an image of this at cprnews.org. In March of 2009, some people came to his house, and that was unusual because it's remote and he was there to get away from people. What happened?
Well, I don't think anyone really knows what happened on that night. What they think happened, according to his friends and brothers, is that some people had broken into his house and he came home and saw the tracks and saw a few things had been moved around in his house, and he was going to go out and look for him. You know, I think he had a bit of a temper, and at that point, no one knows really what happened to Mike. They think he might have seen some people in the distance and chased him down on his motorcycle right at dark, or they think that he might have gone out and just following the tracks. But no one knows really what happened after that point, but they do know that he's never been seen again.
Right. He's never been found. A body has never been found. It's certainly not for a lack of trying. You talked to law enforcement authorities and his brothers and neighbors.
We looked everywhere that they might have gone.
But it's a huge, huge valley, and it's hard to know where to look.
This case bothers me.
I'm sure that Mike just felt a righteous indignation that anyone offended his home, and he had to confront them, and it might have cost him his life.
Do you hope that this film warms up a cold case?
Well, I think it would be nice if there were some answers for Mike's family, of course. I think it's a horrible thing to lose a family member and not ever know what happened to them. So, yeah, it would be nice if the film led to some answers, and I know the brothers and sister of Mike Rust are certainly hoping that it will. You know, the goal of the film wasn't to try and solve Mike's mystery, the mystery of Mike's disappearance. It was to sort of draw light to this bright personality in Colorado history, you know, someone that their story was really already passed by. You know, he disappeared, and it had been 4 years, and the story was gone. And I just thought it was important that someone should tell it before it disappeared totally.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ryan. I really appreciate it.